All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. Real quick, today is going to go quick. We're only recording an hour today. But you know what? If you're in here early, if you were to press 1 on your phone right now with a question, a comment, a topic, you would still have a shot at getting in. The longer you wait, the less likely it is that I'll be able to get to you. But we're going to get started. Here we go.
Your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond,
the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. If you've got questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers. If you've got questions about anything at all, you're in the right place. That's what we do here. We take your calls and we answer your questions about everything trucking. We're going to get to those calls in just a couple minutes. A couple months ago, I was talking about maintenance, and I want to talk about it again. This is one of those areas that I've seen get worse over the years for a lot of reasons. One, trucks and all the systems on trucks are becoming more complicated. Two, we're seeing lots of different types of systems across OEMs. What I mean by that is when I got started in the industry, we really only had a couple engines. Actually, when I got started in the industry, there were still some early Detroit diesels around, but that company was basically out of business. In most trucks, Class A trucks back then, you either had a Cat or a Cummins. I mean, that was really, for the first so many years I was in business, those were really your choices. You could get a Mack engine in a Mack truck, but even that was not very common, certainly in over the road. So the trucks back then were much more simple, a couple engines, and the designs were very similar between those two engines. They used the same starters, same compressors. All kinds of components were the same. You only had a couple models of transmissions and differentials, and you didn't have a lot of proprietary systems. Today, when you look at the options between all the different truck manufacturers, the different engines, the different gears of engines that have changed because of emissions, when you look at all the electronics, when you look at all the add-ons, lots and lots and lots of choices, and the OEMs are doing their own thing. That's what I mean by proprietary. They're designing their own system, so everybody's system is a little different, or sometimes a lot different. And all of those things have made it more difficult today to maintain a truck than it used to be. But it's still as important, more important than it ever used, than it's been. It's always been important, but even more so now. There's another factor. That is the driver or the owner-operator themselves. When I got into the business 30 years ago, most people who went to drive truck had some sort of a mechanical background. It was kind of what brought them to the industry. I think they liked the equipment. Many people came off of farms or, you know, had a history of working on cars growing up. So they had a pretty good understanding of systems and maintenance. And today, that's not true. We have people coming in today that have never worked on their own car, haven't really ever worked on anything mechanical. We have a lot of people coming into the industry today for third careers. And again, many of them don't have a lot of maintenance background. And that's why we see some of the problems we see. Much of it is just because the trucks have become too complicated and emissions. But whether you have a pre-emission truck, an emission truck, maintenance is important, and maintenance is one of those ways that we are able to keep costs down and put more money back in our pocket. That's the whole point of this show. I have a maintenance checklist that I've used over the years, and I added to it here and there, taken away from it here and there. It's not totally complete, but it is a really good list to go through once a quarter and see if there's anything on that list you should be working on. Some of the things you would do every quarter, some of the things on the list you're only going to do once or twice in the lifetime of the vehicle, but they should happen at certain times, and the list will tell you what those times are. So it is a pretty extensive list. It's not everything, but it will really help you a lot if you take this list and look it over once a quarter. And this right now is the most important time to do it. There are some really good winterizing tips on there. I used to have it available as a download on the website, but we move stuff around on the website a lot and things get lost. So I've made it even easier for you now. This is a free download, by the way. We don't charge anything for this. This is just something I want to give to you for being a good, loyal tribe member and because it will help you lower your maintenance cost. Real simple way to go get this form now, go to the website, letstruck.com. At the bottom left of the homepage, you will see a sign-up. Even if you're signed up to our list somewhere else, go ahead and fill it out. We don't duplicate. We always cross-reference email addresses. So you could sign up for our list 15 times, but if you use the same email address, you're only going to get one of each email from us. If you sign up at different times with different email addresses, then there's no way for us to know you've done it twice. But as long as you're using the same email address, don't worry about multiple signups. We're only going to send things to you one time. Go to the website, letstruck.com. Bottom left corner, you'll see a sign-up form. Fill that out, and I will send you that list and also send you more tips in your email box as we go. So speaking of going, let's go to the phones and get some calls in here. Let's go to Pennsylvania. Brian, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call again. I was wondering, I guess I'll give you the opportunity to stretch your memory if you wanted to recap and comment on what we started talking about yesterday. We ran to the end of the clock there, or I did. Sorry about that.
No, that's all right. Refresh my memory because I was working on about 37 things this morning.
Okay. I was talking about, I guess, a little bit of a cautionary tale of getting started, and as a tribe listener, you might get in your head that that it's easy and success is guaranteed, and then seeing, I guess, maybe even seeing problems and just refusing to acknowledge them, and yeah, you know, it's going to be fine. And that kind of thing.
You know, that's a really good point, and there's so much we could talk about that as far as that goes. You know, I make the claim that I've developed a system, three steps to getting started as an owner-operator, and it's three simple steps. You can look at them. I can explain them in 30 seconds. But there's always a lot more to it. And if you were to follow those steps, even if it wasn't 100%, if you were to follow 80%, I could just about guarantee your success. But following those steps is not easy. It's hard work, and there are lots of things that could go wrong. So you bring up a good point. And, you know, another thing we could look at is personality types. I am the eternal optimist. I always know this is going to work. I'll make it work somehow. I'll figure it out. Well, there are times when it doesn't work. But, you know, I go into the next project thinking the exact same thing. The downside to that is you will have things that fail, but I would prefer to go into it very optimistically rather than pessimistically. But some people do the opposite. They look at something and go, wow, look, this could go wrong, or this could go wrong, or this could go wrong. Neither approach is bad as long as you manage them properly. Like, you have to know, if you go into it looking at what's wrong or what could go wrong, you also have to say, okay, I've identified what could go wrong. Let's try to minimize the possibility that it will. And at some point, you do have to focus on what will go right. Now, on the other hand, if you're always optimistic, you've got to stop yourself once in a while and say, okay, this is going to work. I'll figure it out. But what are the things that could go wrong? And if I identify them ahead of time, I'm more likely to see them when they're happening. And I can't just stick my head in the sand and say, it'll be okay. You have to do the hard work. So it's a good point, and I'm going to talk about it some more, but I've got to get to a break. So hold on. We'll come back and talk about that. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rothberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. Before the break, I was talking with Brian in Pennsylvania. So, Brian, you know, the program I'm working on right now, the three steps, is a great example. If you were to do everything in these steps, your odds of succeeding go way up. If you do enough of these steps, they're virtually guaranteed. But things are going to go wrong. And, you know, the difference is, if you don't have an outline or somebody helping you or guiding you, then the odds of things going wrong just go through the roof, and the odds of recovering become much less. So information is key, but it's not everything. You still have to do the hard work, and you have to identify when there really are problems and do something about them.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, without the tribe here and without a personal mechanic recommendation from a friend of mine, I would have been done. I started doing a local intermodal thing, which I'm sure everybody's rolling their eyes about intermodal, but I know there are some people who are able to be very successful with it too. But anyway, I started in February, and by the end of the third quarter, I was netting about $7.75 a week, which I guess isn't terrible, but I didn't listen to one piece of your advice, and I did this with a new baby, a new house, and a wife, so I was really missing the extra $2.50 or so that you expect to make as a company driver, and really had nothing in reserve, praying that it doesn't blow up, and knock on wood, it still hasn't. But I guess a lot of people, there's a lot of negativity, as we all know, and people will tell you, oh, you can't make any money local, and oh, intermodal is the only thing that local that you know sticks, and oh, you can't make any money unless you go get your own authority, which I was not in a position to even attempt. And I've even heard people say you can't make any good money as an owner-operator unless you're hauling contraband. I mean, it's just crazy the stuff you hear. And
well, yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I did the hard work. This is the encouraging part of the story before we get into the numbers. I did some hard work, looked around. I know I didn't want to jump from intermodal dray carrier to intermodal dray carrier like everybody else does. And I just wanted to get out of it. And I found an ad on Craigslist for something for a company driver for an owner-operator in an over-the-road operation. But the company I had never heard of, and I went to their website, was extremely impressed with the information that was actually there and what it was. And I just cold called him. The owner answered, talked to him, had a good conversation. After 4 months of courting and playing phone tag, I'm leased on with them. And in the first 2 months of the fourth quarter, I'm netting $2,500 a week.
Oh, outstanding. Yeah, that is fantastic. And, you know, you this is a good point. You could listen to all the people who say you can't do this, you can't do that. I've done a lot of things in the industry. I did local. I did local P&D. I did local containers. And it's not that you can't make any money. It's just different. You approach that operation very, very differently than you approach it an over-the-road operation. But I loved that kind of work. I thought it was challenging. It kept me busy and active. I met a lot of people, made a lot of connections, and I really enjoyed it. And when I figured out how to do it, I made pretty good money at it. I also made a lot of money being leased to a carrier. I didn't have to have my own authority. I had it at one time, but it was a lot easier to build my business with FedEx doing all the stuff in the background. All I had to do was have trucks and hire drivers. And I made a lot of money being leased to them. So there are 1,000 ways to skin a cat. There are 10,000 ways to make money in trucking. And there are also 10,000 ways to fail in trucking. So it's up to, you know, each individual what they're going to do. And you can find ways to make money in all kinds of different operations. And I've always been interested in the fringes. What are people doing outside of the norm and making money at it? And there's a lot of that going on. So congratulations on sticking with it and figuring out, you know, what works for you. And it sounds like you found a great spot.
Yeah, and I just wanted to note, I am still home every night. I do cross state lines and scale houses now, but I get home every night legally, and it's a very small carrier, so I'm sorry, I can't get everybody else on.
Oh, yeah. No, that's not a problem. You know, people used to tell me that all the time. They'd say, oh, well, you know, you're making money because you're at FedEx, and not everybody can be at FedEx. Well, of course they can't. Not everybody could be anywhere, but I'm not the only one doing really well and making money. We hear from people on this show all the time. Now, the report I've got for you, the business report, is actually showing February through December, so that's really not going to give us a breakdown of what's been going on the last couple months.
Okay. Yeah, and with being a local operation, I don't too much attention to the cents per mile for stuff, and also just because I am getting a lot of nickels and dimes out of, you know, new ownership of an old truck. But I guess, you know, that's the bottom line. I went from $775 a week net to $2,500. I mean, it's incredible.
Oh,
I can't
yeah.
even believe it.
That is incredible. And the good news is, looking at your report, you're doing a good job of managing cost. Maintenance cost was a little high per mile, but you weren't running a lot of miles. And like you said, it's an older truck, takes some time. The first year or two, you can really sink a lot of money into it. But that's not a bad thing. And even after that, your net is really starting to look good. So you had a good first year where you were learning, you were thinking, you weren't being rash and just jumping around carriers. You worked through a process, and now you're reaping the rewards. So call me back once in a while. Let's go over the numbers, but it looks like they are shaping up really nice. Let's go to Ohio. Herschel, welcome
right
to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how are you?
Good. What's on your mind today?
Well, to that last guy's point about intermodal, you know that's what I do. Month's profit gauges, I was 80 cents a mile net after fuel and all expenses.
And that is
so
just outstanding. Yeah.
So you can do it. Now, things got to go right. You know that. But you can do it.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know,
and
part of that things going right is the challenge of...
My real question today is about antifreeze.
Okay.
This truck has the standard green, and I think it's correct in saying it's ethylene glycol. So I have the... I think that's the right name.
You know, I just drew a total blank. There's two glycols. All antifreeze is... ethylene glycol, and Evans, which is a waterless coolant, is propylene glycol. Correct.
Okay. Well, this one is the standard green that we've had forever. So I test it with the little test strips and check the SCAs and add it when it needs it. And this engine does have the water filter. So I keep a preloaded filter on it for maintenance purpose. But my question is, years ago, we have a radiator. We have a top hose that comes from the radiator, goes over to your thermostats. And then there's a bottom hose, goes over to the water pump, and everything circulates. That's all fine and dandy. But now, there's that surge tank up on the firewall. And when doing my test this past weekend with my strips, I was reading that package because I had bought a different brand of strip. And it said, do not test in the surge tank because it'll give you a faulty test. So I'm thinking, first of all, where else would I get it? Because the radiator doesn't even have a cap. And second of all, how in the world does that go out of the tank, over into the radiator, back into the surge tank? Does that coolant in the surge tank ever go anywhere? I've been thinking this through, and I can't for the life of me figure out how in the world it ever goes anywhere.
Well, there's the music, so let me get to a break, and we will come back, and we'll talk about that, because that is a good question. Stick around. We'll be right back. Check out the website, lextruck.com. If you need any help from us off the air, grab something to write with. I'll give you the number. We have a great privateer team. They're there to help. Give them a call, 855-800-FUEL. 855-800-3835. We'll be right back. Kevin Rock. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm going to head back to Ohio. So, Herschel, the reason we don't really want to test that coolant is because that coolant isn't always circulating properly, not the same as the coolant that's still in the radiator running through the engine all the time. Where we would get it, I guess, becomes another question. Every truck's a little different. You would need to find some place to get to the coolant because, again, that surge tank could just be sitting a lot. I You know, with you asking the question, I had to think hard if I really knew this or not. And actually, I don't. I just assumed the surge tank could feed or draw from that same connection based on pressure. But that may or may not be right. Tomorrow, we are going to do a another episode with Pittsburgh Power. That would be a great question for them.
Yeah, because I'm standing here, actually. I just happen to be at my terminal and opened the hood just to see. There's a large line that comes off of the bottom of the tank, and it goes over and across, goes into a metal line, and then over to the other side and into the water pump. That comes off the bottom of the surge tank. And the top radiator hose goes over to your thermostats, of course. Bottom one goes over to the bottom of the water pump. And then there's two small lines that come off the side of the surge tank. One of them is just for overflow and spitting out if it has too much. The other one
right.
is coming over to the passenger side of the head. And they're only about a 3/4 inch line at best. And I'm thinking, how in the world would that coolant ever get out of the bottle and back into that top bottle? Because there's nowhere else to get coolant to test it. So it makes me wonder, am I doing a test on stuff that I'm getting a false test all the time? Now I'm doubting what I should do. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, we will, let's ask Pittsburgh Power that. Because, again, I thought I understood that system until I really had to sit here and think it through. But they'll be able to tell us where the flow goes to, comes from. And then if I need to, we will get somebody from Polaris involved, because we talk to them all the time about coolant analysis. So if we need to, we will get them involved. One way or another, we'll get the right answer to this.
Okay. Thanks, Kevin. I'll give you a call tomorrow and bring it up.
You're welcome. We'll talk about it then. Let's go to Pennsylvania. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Glad everything you guys do for us out here. We appreciate it. Got an oil sample.
All right. So let's take a look. And this is after you had the engine flush done at Pittsburgh Power, correct?
Right. Well, they did it at T&E at the CMC. Remember the bad, all the lead iron you saw was really high. I dumped it 15,000
yeah.
miles ago. And it's a slightly high on the iron, like two times, you know, 34 and 15,000 miles and 19 on the lead. But everything else looks really good. And those weren't even flagged, but I know, you know, usually talk about one part per 1,000 miles would be normally 15 on those, but it looks a lot better once we got all the, I think all the junk from the engine flush went on out the bottom this time, is what it looks like to me.
Yeah, this is actually a good sign. You know, the engine flush is something new. Bruce just showed this to me last year, and we had him come out to the CMC, and we did a bunch, and we're still tracking results. So thank you for sending this in. It did make a huge difference. I mean, you were really getting some buildup in this oil, and now that's all gone. One number I kind of want to just make a comment about. I use that, you know, one part per 1,000-mile rule on iron. But it's typically when I'm looking at extended drains. So, you know, when we're up around 60, 70, 100,000 miles, 150,000 miles on the oil, the first change, that first sample, many times it's almost double that. And that's kind of what you're seeing here. We get a lot of initial iron right off the bat, and then it tends to slow way down. So I not worried at all about your iron number or your lead, and it looks like the flush was successful.
Yeah, it was. I would insist next time on flushing and then dumping, you know, because we put the OPS on. It had already been changed, I think, when the two gentlemen that owned the company, that they were there at the CMC. I can't remember their names, but they went over to T&E and so I think the oil had already been dumped, the OPS was on, then they did the engine flush. I think that's the order. It should have been done in the other order. It should have been done first, dump the oil, then put the OPS on. But I think Chris and them had already done that work when they went over and did the flush. I think that's why we ended up with all the gunk in the oil. Now, my oil was black again in 3 miles coming back to CMC. I know they say it'll clear up for a while, but a Detroit is always dirtier. I think the little ports and all in there can hold a lot more little bits of oil and dirt, I'm sure. And I'm sure this helps in that regard. The only thing I looked at here, I mean, everything looked real good. I know the 2.8 on the fuel dilution, it's probably okay. The one thing on the Polaris now, they don't have anywhere for us to put our lube added on that new little form we got. So it's always coming up zero. But, you know, I'm putting one in every 5,000. So I'm kind of looking for next summer for a good end frame. Next summer, anyhow. But my soot 0.1. I mean, I was real happy with all of that. And oxidation low, base is good. I'm gonna go another 25 this time before I take another sample and change out the OPS filters. That's your recommendation also?
Yeah. Yeah, you're doing everything right. Just keep doing what you're doing. For an engine that is approaching the end of its life, like you said, it's going to need an in-frame, you know, sometime in 2016. And knowing that this engine looks really good, that sample looks good, 2.8 on fuel dilution is virtually nothing. Soot numbers are excellent. Wear metals are back in line. So, yeah, just keep doing what you're doing. Let's go to Arizona. Rusty, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I run in-state only and never across state lines, and I don't have an MC number. So what I'm dealing with is I've got a broker that I did work for about a month, and then he didn't pay me for almost 4 months, and now he's starting to pay me for one load each Friday. He makes me a check. But what I'm finding out in trying to collect from him and his bond company is that they don't have any jurisdiction or won't honor the bond because the loads were picked up and delivered within the same state. Is there any way to protect myself from unscrupulous brokers?
Yeah, there is. The bond, you know, the bond has never been all that reliable anyway, because many times when brokers go out, they go out owing so much money that bond wouldn't even come close to touching it. So even if you were in an operation where you could collect against the bond, it may or may not do any good. So I say that because I don't want people to depend on that bond thinking that would always solve their problems. Most of the time it doesn't. So we fall back to whether you're in your situation, which is intrastate, which can get pretty screwy. What state do you happen to be in? I'm familiar with a lot of intrastate rules in some states, but I'm not familiar with Arizona. But it does bring up many different issues when you do that. But it doesn't really matter in the case of working with brokers or shippers in any business. Anytime you extend credit, you're running a risk. And there are things you could do to minimize your risk. One of the things you should be doing is checking the credit rating of the broker before you use them. I mean, that's the minimum. And that doesn't guarantee anything, but it at least tells us if they've got a good history or not. If you check a credit rating on a broker and they've got a lousy history, then that would throw up a lot of red flags that if you were ever to pull a load for them, you don't want to get too deep into them until you see how they pay. What I mean is you don't want to run 10 loads before you ever get paid for one. So when you're using a new broker, you always check credit, then ease into the relationship. So pull a load, wait to get paid, see what things are like, pull another load, wait to get paid. Maybe after a couple of those, you could have two or three loads outstanding. But just remember that the more credit you have outstanding, the more risk you are putting yourself at, no matter what we do to try to protect that. So the music's playing. I'm going to get to a break. We'll come back. We'll talk a little bit more about that. Stick around. Kevin Rockford. ¶¶ Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment. I'm going to get right back to the call. So, Rusty, you know, one thing, checking credit, not getting too deep into somebody till you know how they pay. And third, and I think most important is, I say this line all the time. I talk about it when we talk about repair shops. You've got to build relationships. Now, none of these things are a guarantee you're going to get paid, but all of them will give you better odds at getting paid. So you identify a broker you want to work with, you check credit, you pull a load for them, you wait to get paid, you go visit them personally if things are working out good, you build relationships with them, and that will greatly increase the chances that you're going to get paid.
Well, that's what basically all what I did over there, January, February, March, and then came April. Up until April, I'd only hauled like 6 loads for them and gotten paid, and I'd met with all 3 of the owners. And then April came in, and they asked me if I would come haul for them every day. I had tons of work, and so I did, and that's when I didn't get paid for any of those loads for several months, and now I'm starting to collect on it. The story I've got from them is that their general manager walked off with several $1 million, and so they just didn't have the money to pay me, and so they're trying to pay me, but, you know, they didn't have any credit to begin with because they're fairly new.
So you know then you were taking a risk. I mean, and
yeah,
that's part of business, and there are certain things that there really is no protection against. Risk is risk. And we have to manage that risk. I mean, you did a couple things that put you at risk. And we can go over them again. You worked with a broker that was new, so you can't see their credit history. You have no idea whether they're going to pay well or not. You got very, very deep into them because you went months without getting paid. That's, I mean, all these choices are yours, but you have to understand they increase your risk. Now, it sounds like there might be a happy ending here because they are at least attempting to pay you. And I think that's because you did build the relationship. You went and met with them. They know you personally. It sounds like they are working to get you paid. So it looks like this could work out. But just know in the future that you did some things that really increased your odds of taking a hit on this. And you have to think about that in the future. Are you willing to do that, or do you have to stay on top of your collections closer? And you need to set a limit. If somebody gets 60 days behind or 45 days behind or whatever your number is, then you cut them off. And you say, if you want to minimize your risk, you cut them off and you say, I'm not going to pull another loan until you pay me for this one. And if you pay me for this
one,
I'll pull one more. But if
I cut them off.
That's really all you can do. Yeah.
Okay.
Excellent. And that's really all you can do. You know, and any time you run a business and you extend credit, that's risky. I mean, we do it on the CMC. We offer a payment plan, and we don't do credit checks. Somebody could come to me with the worst credit in the world, and I'm still going to finance them on the CMC. That's the risk we take. Now, we have a really, really good track record of people paying us. Every once in a while, we have to chase somebody around. But we know we're taking a big risk because we have no collateral. We don't do any credit checks. But doing business, and it's a risk I've chosen to accept. If you are going to extend credit to brokers, it's a risk you're going to accept. Maybe you negotiate, you know, an advance on every load so you at least cover some of your cost of that load. There are several ways you can manage this, but it sounds like you're doing some of these things and the risk that's left is just part of doing business. Let's go to Kentucky. Brian, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hey, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call.
What can I help you with today?
I've got a couple of questions on that low carb. What's the max on the carb that I can take in that, like, a 24-hour period?
So have you started? And I want to clarify something because I'm not a fan of calling it a low-carb diet, even though it is. I would prefer to focus on what we can eat, not what we can't. And the best way to do
right.
ketogenic diet we're talking about, but if we're talking
right.
about the macronutrients, we would describe it as a high fat. So we know our meals are based around fat. It's a high fat diet with moderate protein. This isn't a high protein diet. It's a moderate protein diet and low carb. So high fat,
right.
low carb, moderate protein. So have you started it yet, or are you getting ready to start?
I'm wanting to start it. I kind of cut back on my eating a lot, you know, but I just want to try to figure out what I can eat and what I shouldn't eat, you know.
Got it. Okay. So, again, focus on what you can eat, which are good quality fats. A good mix of animal and plant-based fats. So, you know, good beef, good fatty beef, if it can be grass-fed or organic, that's excellent. Pork, the fattier cuts, again, try to keep it organic, pasture-raised when you can. If you're going to eat chicken, eat the skin and eat the fattier parts. Don't just eat a boneless, skinless chicken breast. Eat a skin-on chicken thigh. Add fats to your meats when you're eating them, either, you know, butter or cream-based sauces, mayonnaise, things like that, that will add some more fat so it's not so high in the protein. Avocados are something you should be eating every day. Nuts are good. Butter is an excellent source of fat. Eggs are good fats. Olive oil on salads and things like that is good. Lots of coconut oil. So those are all the things you can eat: meat, fish, vegetables, and good fats. That should really be the basis of your diet.
Okay, because I've started eating, you know, you can get hard-boiled eggs in the truck stop, and I get the salads at Subway and stuff like that. Is that good like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, meat, fish, eggs, dairy if you can handle it, and a lot of vegetables. Those are the things you can eat, and that includes a lot of food. What you really want to cut back on are sugars and starches. That's the carbs. So in the beginning, I recommend that people go under 20 net grams of carbs a day. So when you're looking at net grams of carbs, you take the total carbs on the label and subtract the fiber. We want the fiber, so we don't try to limit how much fiber you could get. Get as much as you want. Just watch the net carbs. So total carbs minus fiber gives you net carbs. And staying under 20 is really difficult. But you're only going to do that for 2 weeks. In that first 2 weeks, you even have to be careful of the vegetables. Because if you eat a lot of vegetables, it's easy to go over 20 grams of carbs. So in the first 2 weeks, you really, really focus on fats and a little bit of protein. You're going to keep the carbs way, way down under 20 for 2 weeks. That'll jumpstart the whole process. You'll see amazing results. Then what you do is you start experimenting with what works for you as the number of carbs. So you eat as much fat as you want till you're full. You keep your protein around 100 grams a day or less, and then you figure out where you can be as far as carbs go. And the best way to tell that is your weight. So for me, I stay between 50 and 60 grams of carbs a day. If I go back under 20, like in the beginning, I can start losing weight again, but I don't want to. I like my weight where it is, and my weight will stay where it is if I keep my carbs between 50 and 60 grams a day. I know some people who can go up to 100 and do just fine. I know other people who have to stay below 30 forever because they're insulin resistant. You know, they may have been pre-diabetic or they were a type 2 diabetic and they're not anymore. The diet will fix that. But it may take years to get back to the point where they would be able to eat and tolerate carbs again. So it's really different for everybody. And you just play around and you find your level. And it's actually pretty easy. I know it sounds complicated in the beginning and it feels like you got to count all this different stuff. But you get the hang of this pretty quick. I don't my food anymore. I don't count my carbs. I don't write things down. I'm not using an app anymore. I know what I can eat during the day. And my meals are really good fats, a little bit of protein, and a lot of vegetables. And, you know, 50 to 60 grams of carbs when I'm not eating any sugar allows me to eat a lot of good vegetables. Just stay away from the starchy ones. If it grows above ground, it's good. If it grows below ground, you got to be careful with those. That's going to do it for me. I'm all out of time. We'll see you back here next show. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody, thanks for joining us today. It is a short day. We're just doing that 1 hour. I'll give you a heads up. If everything goes right tomorrow, I'm working on another episode with Pittsburgh Power. We'll do an episode of Destination Health tomorrow. And depending on how many questions we have and what they are, we may even do a third hour tomorrow, but we'll see. So we'll send out a text, but plan on joining us tomorrow. Thanks.